Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
KYW News Radio, original podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with somebody that you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One.
I always told my assistants, and this is how I approach the job, I said, I want you to approach the job as you are the head coach. Treat it like every decision is yours. There was such a trust with Phil and myself that he gave me a lot of rope. I could never ask for more. But he trusted me in every regard, so I enjoyed every day.
And our guest this week is Dave Duda, the athletic director at Delaware Valley University in Doylestown. He has had success at several different levels across the Philadelphia area as a basketball coach and now doing the AD thing. And Dave, thanks so much for taking the time.
Anytime, Matt. Glad to spend some time with you.
So you are the athletic director at Delaware Valley University, a Division III school with a lot of high-quality programs. How has, we'll talk about the pandemic in a second, but overall, you've been on the job now about a year and a quarter. How's it going?
It's been great, Matt. You know, it's been great to be back, back on the administrative side. Certainly a little bit easier with a place that I've been so familiar with. And some of the same names were here, which certainly helped a whole lot. And I just wish we were in normal times because I was looking forward to us having a take another step forward as a department with a lot of our programs in year two. Now that I had a better lay of the land and a feel for everything. And then obviously the pandemic interrupted a lot. So a lot of things that I was looking forward to because I thought we were taking a lot of steps in some positive directions.
I'm not going to ask how much of a challenge has this all been in the times of COVID-19, because it's obviously been a huge one. But how difficult is it? This is something I'm guessing there's not really an administrative playbook for how to handle this. So every day a new adventure?
Yeah, you know, I think the hardest part of this, Matt, is, you know, when you sit in my chair, you're someone who has to provide answers. And people look to you for guidance. And then, you know, coaches are creatures of habit. Student athletes are creatures of habit. They like a schedule. They like to know what they're doing when they're doing it. And I feel so bad because the best answer that I give most of the time is I don't know. And I hate giving that answer, but it's the truthful answer because this changes daily. It changes on the fly. You plan. Like we did in the fall, we planned all summer and it never materialized. And that's frustrating. It's frustrating for coaches. It's frustrating for student athletes, but so much of this is out of your hands. So the not being able to provide clear answers from my chair is very, very frustrating.
So let's talk a little bit about your career overall. You made a lot of hay as a basketball coach, basketball player. Was basketball always the main focus growing up, or were you a kid that played everything in the neighborhood?
I played all the sports, and then, you know, when I got into the high school sports, certainly realized that, you know, basketball was my ticket, and that's what I wanted to play. And then, you know, the coaching bug was always in me, and that was my first love. And then when I got to Widener, certainly got to see the administrative side of things, being an assistant athletic director for half my time there and the other half being the AD. So I always liked that part of it. And to leave Widener, really, to chase my ultimate goal was always to be a Division I head coach, and I knew I needed to go as an assistant to take that step. And the whole time, I always liked leading. Leading was always a thing that I liked. And when this opportunity arose at Delaware Valley, after, you know, an unfortunate end at St. Joseph's, I was glad this came up. And, you know, it certainly changed a lot, because the combination of being a head coach and an AD isn't that prevalent anymore, because all of the layers that go with the AD job now. So, and I could see it. I could see how it changed just in that time period that I was at St. Joe's, how that AD role has changed. So, but I was very happy to be back in this role.
What's your earliest basketball memory growing up?
Wow, it's a great question. I think my first memory was probably playing in a YMCA league. I remember my coach, his name was Coach Baker. I was probably about 6 or 7 at the time. And he was the first coach, and a lot of my coaches will laugh at this, but at that age, I could shoot it probably better than a lot of the kids I played against. And he just said, keep shooting it. And it kind of stuck with me my entire career, but I can remember him back. That was probably my earliest memory, probably at the age of 6.
Are you playing basketball with an eye towards, you know, playing in high school and playing in college? Or when does it go from just something you're doing, you know, for fun to something that you think, you know what, maybe I can, you know, make a run in this in one way or another?
Well, I think I was very fortunate, Matt, much more so than others at that time, because my high school coach, people don't realize the connection, but my high school coach was Phil Martelli when he was a high school coach at Bishop Kenman. And he was so ahead of the game at that time. And he really ran our high school program like a college program. And it was really dog eat dog. Like, I would work out with the varsity when I was in 8th grade, and you just got thrown to the wolves. And it was a really good program. And you either learned how to compete or you never got on the court. And that's a different setting than a lot of people are exposed to at such a young age. So I was really fortunate to have just terrific coaching in high school. And, you know, then, and it worked the same way when I started my college career, you know, to start with Herb McGee, who's in the Hall of Fame. You know, it's just, you're so ahead of the curve when you have those type of mentors really showing you the way.
So you played at Bishop Kenrick. You went to Bishop Kenrick, correct?
Yep.
So you mentioned playing for Phil Martelli, and obviously you've coached with him on his staff for years. How did Phil Martelli that you had at Bishop Kenrick differ from the Phil Martelli we know from St. Joe's?
It's drastic, and you would laugh, because he really does not like to talk about the high school Phil Martelli, because he was a lot different than the college Phil Martelli. I mean, he does not, to give you the difference. In all my time at St. Joe's, we never ran a suicide. He doesn't believe in running and anything like that. Yet when I was in high school, if you sneezed the wrong way, you ran a suicide and you ran until your tongue fell out. You know, and he always says to me, he goes, I don't even know if I could have kept my job, some of the things I did, you know, in the 80s coaching in high school that I do now. So, you know, but he's grown a whole lot. You got to remember, you know, probably when he coached me in high school, I don't know, he might have been 28, 29 years old as a head coach. So you certainly learn throughout the processes. But, you know, the person was the same. And he was such a great coach in high school and obviously in college. So, but he just changed. But times changed as well. It was just a different way of coaching back then. And, you know, when we did something wrong in high school and got yelled at by the coach, our parents would say, the coach is right. Go back there and listen to him. You know, that's changed a little bit, Matt. That's not exactly the way it works anymore. Everybody doesn't share that same philosophy. So time certainly changes as well.
What kind of player were you in high school? How would you describe your game?
I was a scoring two guard, and I made first team all Catholic as a senior in a very, very good league, and then was recruited by a number of universities, and I ended up going to an NAI school, Spring Garden College, because that was the best package financially for me. I just missed scoring 2,000 points in college. Was the all-time leading scorer at Spring Garden, which I'm the only one that could say that record could never be broken because the school closed. So that record will remain. But my game was always centered around scoring the ball on the particular teams that I was on.
And you mentioned the coaching bug. Once your college days are over, do you know that I'm gonna be a coach one way or another?
Yeah, Matt, at that time, there weren't as many opportunities to go play overseas and that type of thing that there are today. So it wasn't really a thought, but I knew like my playing days were over, but what can I do to coach? And I met Coach McGee through the recruiting process when I was a high school player. And when I got out, I was fortunate right away to be able to get a job on his staff. And, that was like advanced basketball. There's no one who teaches the game better than him. And, to be under him for 7 years and have the run that we had there. But in addition to that, whether it was winning or not, just what I was able to learn from him in terms of basketball and his philosophies, it just gave me another perspective that I used in a lot of my stays after that.
Did you realize at the time, because you're young, who you were getting the chance to learn on the sideline with? I mean, you knew he was a good coach, he'd recruited and all, but did it take a while to kind of hit you, like what you're getting a front row seat to?
Matt's one of those things you never know you had till you don't have it anymore. And that's when when I became my own head coach, you got to remember my first job, I took over Delaware Valley. They were 0-23. And just having a halftime lead was hard to do. And you realize, wow, that guy wins like 25 games like every year by accident, and how easy it was for him to win. Now, it's not easy to win any game, like he would tell you that. But you realize when you look back after you're gone and you go, wow, what he's able to do on a yearly basis, it's incredible. Like I actually looked one time at his record when he went past the 1,000 win mark. And I said, he can actually coach another 20 years and not win a game and be over 500. And to think like an over 500 coach is considered pretty good. He could not win a game for another 20 years and he'd still be over 500. It's just staggering. But I'm glad he got his recognition being in the Hall of Fame, which lower level coaches don't get, because he's truly, truly at that elite level.
I saw somewhere that the time you were an assistant there, you guys went at Philadelphia University, now Jefferson, 171 up, 35 down. What was it like when you win like that? Is it difficult to keep the edge? Because I do a lot of Jefferson games, there are certain nights that you're just so much better than the other team, you're going to win. How hard is it to keep an edge for the kids and all when you're having that type of high level success?
Matt, I think with him, it started with he wants that in practice every day. Like everybody always gets on him because he only plays five guys, maybe six. And, every day in practice, he would take the five starters and maybe the sixth man, and he would give me players 7 through 12, and we would scrimmage. And he wasn't happy unless his team won by 30, because they should win by 30. And he demanded that every day. And that kind of carried over to how we played in every single game. And, when I look back at that period, he's had some great periods, but that run was ridiculous in the fact that, I think he passed the 500 and 600 win mark during that time. And we also won 80 consecutive home games during that time. So when you win 80 straight, you almost get to a point like you just don't expect to lose. And it really got that way. We felt so comfortable playing. Not that, obviously we were winning on the road a lot, but at home you felt invincible. You really did. You felt like, no matter close game, tight game, it's going to go our way. But I'm literally saying like
he practiced that every day. And, you know, I just try to do my best to keep the second team in a scrimmage. But that's how he wanted it. And it certainly carried over.
Biggest thing you learned from him?
I would say that he was so good at getting the right players the shots. Like he's thought of as like this shooting doctor and everything like that. But yeah, he let good shooters shoot. Like, not every kid on our roster was a good shooter, and they weren't allowed to shoot the ball. But he was so good at getting the right guys the right shot at the right time. And how he did that, he was so technical in his teaching. This is what he was great at. If the play said, take 5 steps and cut on a 45-degree angle to the elbow, you took that many steps and you cut on that angle to the elbow. You didn't catch it 2 steps above the elbow. You didn't catch it below the elbow. You caught it on the elbow. And we practiced that until it looked like that. So when people say, man, his offense, you know, it's impeccably the way it runs. Yeah, that's how we practiced it. And that's what that was the beauty of him. That was his strength.
Do you have a Herb McGee story you can share with us? Because I think everybody I know that has worked with him, worked around him, worked for him has at least one.
I will. I'll have to give you the clean version of this story, but this is my favorite story with him. People love when I tell this story. So it was when I first started in the league has changed, but the big rival game used to be Textile and Gannon. And if anybody doesn't realize, when you go to Erie, Pennsylvania, they filled that arena with every townsperson. There was you played in front of 4,000 people. And there was a time when I got there, Herb had said, man, we hadn't won in Gannon in like forever. We just hadn't won. And when you went, you had travel partners. So we played Gannon and Mercyhurst back to back. So we were playing Gannon first. And I'll never forget this, because Eddie Malloy, who's now an NBA referee, he transferred from St. Joe's, and it was his first game after break, and we were going to Gannon. We had a really good team, and you know, I did everything I could with the scouting report. Everything went according to plan. We win the game. We have an unbelievable win. And after the game, you know, Herb and I go have a couple drinks, and he went, I got to tell you, that was terrific. That was an unbelievable job you did tonight. I felt so good about myself. So the next day, we play Mercyhurst, who has 4 wins. It should be a game that we should win going away. The opposite happens. It's one of those days where nothing's going right. We can't get over the hump. We have like a 5-point lead the whole game. They keep coming at us, keep coming at us, keep coming at us. He looks at me in the second half on the bench, and he goes, what do you got? And I said, I got to tell you, I got nothing. And he goes, you know what? You're about as useful as my blank. And you could imagine the body part that he was referring to at that time. So he went from the night before telling me how great I was to that. Right, he snapped that comment out right on the bench. We ended up pulling out the win. But that was just, you know, that was Herb. You know, the people who know him, that's how he talks. And I always laugh with him about that particular story.
When do you start? I mean, you obviously, you know, you want to be a head coach. But when do you start thinking, I'm ready and I want to pursue an opportunity? Is it when the Del Valle job comes along, or had you started thinking a few years before that, you know what, I feel like I can take the next step?
I think it was both. I think he always told me, you know, he thought I was ready a lot earlier than that. You got to remember, back in those days, Matt, the Division I level did not have the amount of positions that they have now. So you didn't have a video coordinator. You didn't have an operations director. You either had one of those assistant jobs or you didn't get them. So they were a lot harder to come by. There weren't as many full-time Division II assistant jobs. So when the Del Valle job opened up, he literally said to me, he goes, look, I think you can get it, no problem, but I'm not sure you want to take that. He goes, are you sure? And even when I told him I want to take it, he still said, look, I think you could get something better somewhere down the line. But I looked at it as I knew how hard I was going to work at the job. I knew it was in the area. I knew I could keep all the recruiting contacts. And there was certainly nowhere to go from up, even though it was a really challenging conference that I was going into.
So you take over Del Valle, and you mentioned earlier, you're taking over a group that's 0-23. And you just spent, you know, close to a decade losing maybe once every 6 months. How tough, even though you know what you're getting into, how tough is that mentally at first as you guys are improving, but you've got to deal with losing at a level that you hadn't dealt with in a long time.
Yeah, I think my wife would probably answer that one better for you. She did not like that first year very much. But I would say, you know, when I got the job, I think it was late March, and we had to replace this roster. And we got a lot of guys, but they were more warm bodies than they were basketball players. And I thought I was very proud of that team, though. My first year at Del Valle, we won 4 games, but we had the lead at halftime in 13 of our 24 games. So I thought that team did a great job of carrying out scouting report. They just couldn't finish at the end. And then obviously year two, when we had a whole year to recruit, that's when it turned. But I thought the staff and the players did a great job in that first year of just trying to be competitive. And certainly they were the guys who started to change the culture a bit.
We talk about dealing with losing, but on the other side, you're taking over a winless team. So I would guess every coach puts pressure on themselves, but you're starting basically from ground zero. How much did that help that there's really only up to go?
Yeah, and we never even brought it up in recruiting, because I think the people in the area knew where I was coming from, and I had won before, and I just used the same line. Look, I didn't have a thing to do with that record or the performance of that other team. So I think when you have a clean slate, everybody looks at you in that way. And it didn't take long. Like I said, it changed. But there were times I felt for that first team, because we were just a little bit outmanned on nights.
Time for a break on One-on-One. We will have more with Delaware Valley University Athletic Director Dave Duda right after this.
Hey, everybody, it's Cherry Gregg here. You may know me around town as KYW News Radio's community affairs reporter, but every week I produce and host Flashpoint, a podcast where we highlight the hot topics in Philadelphia, local newsmakers and change makers burning things up in our region. From gerrymandering to gender equality and policing in schools, we'll walk you through the flames on Flashpoint. It's available wherever you downloaded this podcast that you're listening to now. So subscribe. Thanks so much.
And we are back. Our guest this week on One-on-One, Delaware Valley University Athletic Director Dave Duda. So you go from 0-23 your first year, and in 2 years you've got that to 500. I think it was the first non-losing season in over a decade. How does the Widener opportunity, that's the next step, how does that come about?
Yeah, it was unique because I was sitting in my office about the same time in March. And, Widener had gone through a transition because it was an ugly situation because, C. Allen Rowe had been let go. And obviously he was a legendary coach at Widener. And I was in my office one day, and Herb actually called me and said he got off the phone with the athletic director at Widener at the time, who said, "Hey, you think Dave would have any interest?" And, it wasn't a job that I applied for or anything like that. And I just said, "What do you think?" And he said, "Look, the mentors I always go to, Phil and Herb, said to me, look, you got to take a look at that." And, Phil was a graduate of Widener and said, "Look, you want to win a national championship? That's a place where it's been done before. You can do it." And I went and met with the people at Widener, and certainly they were a little more ahead of the game in terms of facilities and academic offerings at that time. And it was a similar situation, Matt, really, because I inherited there a 6-win team. But, having just gone through it and said, well, I don't think it'll take that long. I didn't exactly have a timeline, but that's really what precipitated the move to Widener.
So how did you approach that first year as Widener compared to that first year at Del Valle? Or I should say, what did you take from that Del Valle experience to accelerate things at Widener?
Well, it was similar because, the first thing you do is you evaluate the team. And I said, well, this roster is going to have to be upgraded. I had one player, Chris Hightower, who was a kid from St. Joe's Prep, who was a freshman at Widener, had a really good year. I knew I wanted to keep him, but he was very, very integral. He was one of the best captains I ever had. And he integrated the kids that I had coming in. And remember, a lot of the kids that I were recruiting at Del Valle, I didn't have to make up a new recruiting list. It was still Division III kids. I would have recruited them at any school at that level. So the transition, I was really ahead of the game because it was the same type of recruiting. I didn't have to change levels or locations or anything like that. And I was really excited about that first recruiting class. And obviously what they did there was terrific. They were such a great core group going forward. And again, there was no timeline there, but we made the playoffs in year one. And, you know, year two, we won 24 games. And I think we were as high as sixth or seventh in the country at one point. So I was really proud of that group and what they were able to do.
Were you surprised at all at how quickly that success came, or did it make did you know what you were doing? You felt like this is how it should work. We should be at this level.
Well, the difference there, Matt, was I was hired by Bob Bruce, who was the president, a fantastic president, and he lets you know in the interview process. He goes, "Dave, you're coming here to win. I want to win. We have a level of expectation that's not heard at all D3 schools." Like that's exactly how he spoke. And so I knew what the expectations were. And, you know, you look at the history of Widener, they were in the NCAA. You go walk in the gym, there's a lot of tournament banners hanging up on the wall. So that's the expectation there than it was both football and basketball, in addition to some other sports. So I had that in my mind right away. But I had the same mindset with Del Valle. I wasn't anticipating Del Valle just being okay, being 500. You know, my next year there, I was hoped that we could have won the league. So I knew what we can do, and would I say it was a little easier? Not effort-wise, but, I mean, the academic offerings helped a little bit more at Widener, and the reputation helped a little bit more, but very, very similar approaches.
So 8 years as head coach at Widener. I want to talk about the AD angle in a second, but three trips to the NCAA tournament, Sweet 16 in 2006. When you think to that time at Widener, what are the memories that are right at the top of the list for you?
Wow, you know, I think there, Matt, it really made me who I am today, the whole place. I loved it from top to bottom, not just the basketball coaching part of it. I went through two presidents. They were both fantastic. I had terrific bosses in both places. It's unbelievable support. I met so many great people. And then when I became the athletic director there, I was also on the senior leadership team. And I don't ever think I learned more in a four-year period from people that just weren't in basketball. I mean, from academic deans to influential people all over the campus, of just how it gave me a global view of how a department and a university works. It helped me grow. It helped me grow as a leader, not just as a leader coaching basketball, but in a leader of people in many other areas.
So about halfway through, you do take on the title of athletic director in addition. How big a step was that, and how did that change your day to day?
I'll tell you what, the first year I was awful. I was awful, man. It was the only year my team never made the playoffs, and we had all kinds of injuries, and everybody on campus blamed it on that. Well, if you had this guy, I know. But for the first time, I didn't manage everything. I was really poor at delegating. I wanted to do everything myself. I wanted to convince everybody that I could do this job. And for the first time, I was exhausted at the end of the year, like physically and mentally exhausted. And I went to my boss, Joe Baker, who was terrific. And I said, "Joe, I have to restructure." And he allowed me to do some things. And we changed the department a little bit. And I had two great assistant ADs, Larissa Gillespie and Jack Schaefer. Jack is now the AD at Widener. And I was able to delegate to them because I knew I trusted them. And year two, three, and four were very, very smooth in the transition. But year one, I did not feel I did a very, very good job there because I didn't have the right handle on all the duties. And my team suffered, and I still feel bad for that team. That was the one team I think didn't max out in my time at Widener.
So your last year at Widener is the year you guys go to the Sweet 16 in the NCAA tournament. What was that ride like?
Well, you know, it was for me, because I thought I had other teams that should have gotten to that level. And the thing that frustrates you at Division III is it's really not a national tournament. It's much more of a national tournament now. When I was there, it was more of a regional tournament. And for example, so my first team that went, I thought they had a shot to win the national title. We played F&M in the second round. We got a bye in the first round. F&M went to the Final Four. But if you look nationally, both of us were top 10 in the country playing a second round game. My second team that went, same situation. We had a bye. We played Catholic. Catholic won the national championship. We played in the second round. We lost to F&M by three and lost to Catholic by one. But that's how close you are to winning a national championship. Yet you're playing a game in the second round of the NCAA tournament, which wouldn't happen in today's world. And I thought that, you know, that Sweet 16 run, I was so proud of that team because they had to go to York, who was fourth in the country. York had won 33 straight, and we beat them to advance to the Sweet 16. And even in the Sweet 16 game, my best player, first team All-American, Christian Clarkson, played two bad games all year. The first game of the season and the last game of the season, not his fault. I mean, obviously, he just came up a little short in what his norm was, but it was a terrific run by that team. That team was really a lot of fun to coach.
So then you go from Widener and you go to serve with your high school coach, Phil Martelli, as an assistant at St. Joe's. Was this a situation of it was a simple phone call and you made the decision? How'd the transition to that come?
No, you know, what precipitated it, Matt, during my time at Widener, I interviewed for a lower level Division I job because of the success we had at Widener. And it was really what the athletic director told me at the end of the process that made me make the move. He was great, the athletic director. And he said to me at the end, he said, "Dave, the committee thought you could do it. I think you can do it." He goes, "But we're going to hire a BCS assistant coach. And part of this is I have to win the press conference." And I said to him at the time, I said, "Yeah, but don't you think you have to hope that that guy could be a head coach, at least with me. I have a track record of being a successful head coach." He said, "Dave, I totally understand it, but there's more to it at this level." And at that time, I started thinking to myself, well, I could go to the NCAA tournament three more times here at Widener, win X amount of games. It's not going to get me over that hurdle. I didn't have Division I on my resume. So when Phil had an opening, you know, there was a common interest, and I was so thrilled to go there. I didn't think I would be there. I thought it would happen a lot quicker than it did. So did Phil. But you really realize when you're at that level how difficult it is to get one of those jobs, because it's not like being an accountant or a school teacher. There's only X amount of jobs that you can get, both regionally and level wise, you know, coming from a school like St. Joe's. So I had many opportunities, was close a number of times, but like every job, Matt, it's really about getting an opportunity and then what you can do with it.
How tough was it? You've been a head coach now at this point for a decade, and you've, in addition to the head coach, you've been the athletic director. How tough was it going from kind of the final decision maker to being an assistant again? Did you find yourself having to catch yourself sometimes?
I did, but I think that a couple things. I think being an assistant before and being a head coach, you get both perspectives. And I always told my assistants, and this is how I approach the job, I said, "I want you to approach the job as you are the head coach. Treat it like you're the head coach. Treat it like every decision is yours. Treat it as, you know, even though you're not making the ultimate decision." And there was such a trust with Phil and myself that he gave me a lot of rope. I could never ask for more. He trusted me. We had a lot of great conversations, some difficult conversations during that time when we weren't doing so well. But he trusted me in every regard. So maybe at other places it would have been harder, Matt, or more difficult working with other guys who are more taskmaster kind of guys. But that was a terrific run with Phil. I enjoyed every day.
And I asked you about Widener. What are some of the memories? Because you guys had a lot of success. Three NCAA tournaments, couple of A-10 titles. When you think about your time with St. Joe's, what's at the top of the list for memories there?
Well, I think the championships, there's nothing like it because there's so much pressure to win. And then there's the thrill of knowing that your name's going to get called on Selection Sunday, and then being able to share it with my family. You know, my son is a freshman or a sophomore basketball player at East Stroudsburg. You know, and he was, when we won those two titles, he was in seventh grade and ninth grade. And to see the joy that it brought him and how it promoted his love for the game and growing up in the gym around that, that was special because Phil allowed the families to share in it as well. So you didn't feel like you were so much, you were away from your family, but your family was all a part of it, which was, you know, his family first environment meant a lot.
How frustrating the last few years are at St. Joe's before the changes made. I thought there might not have been a team in the country that lost more to injury than you guys. And it wasn't just the number of injuries. It was who got injured. From a coaching standpoint, I understand next man up and all that. But it has to hit a point where you're like, my goodness, if we could just get a couple of months with all these kids healthy, it could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and that's how you plan it. You look back and you say, hey, the years that we won it, you didn't have any of those injuries. It was fun. You could grow. You could develop. And, I'm not one of those guys, about crying sour milk and feel for me and woe is, because we never did that. But ultimately, when you sit down as coaches behind closed doors, you do say, hey, this roster is just not going to get it done, because that's a very good league. When you're playing Dayton, VCU, and UMass and St. Louis night in, night out, and you're minus three big guns, you just can't. You don't have enough guys. You just, it's not Kentucky. It's not North Carolina. It's not any of the kind of places. You just don't have enough. So it does get frustrating. And it got to a point where you're like, not again, because we had some kids who it was their second time. We're like, not again. And you feel for the kids first because they put so much into it at that level and so much time. But you did. I mean, it's just human nature. You don't give in on game day. But, when you're alone by yourself, you say, wow, this is tough to do with what we have.
So when it did come, when St. Joe's makes the change and parts ways with Phil and everybody has to go, how difficult was that? Was it something, I don't know if you ever expect it, but had you guys kind of braced yourself that something could be coming down the road?
I don't know. It was always in the back of my mind, Matt, but I'll be honest, when it happens, everybody, deals with it their own way. For me, the hardest part was, for the first time in my career that was very, very successful, someone in so many words said, you're not good enough. And the hurt really came from how many people I felt I let down. First you let yourself down, then you let your family down. I feel like I let Phil down. I felt like, you let all the great people that you met there, because I met way more great people at St. Joe's than I did the other way. And you feel like you let them down. You let the players down. I felt for a time, even with my friends, I feel like, am I wearing the scarlet letter, so to speak? Like you're walking around with this L on your chest. And, not that anybody felt that way, because it happens all the time. But that was the hardest part for me, just feeling like, man, did I let a lot of people down here? And, and there's a part of the emotional scar that I don't know if I obviously recovered, but there's like a scar that, will always be there.
So after that, you do land at Del Valle. We've talked about the gig at Del Valle. How much do you miss coaching? I'm sure the job keeps you very busy, but how much do you miss the day to day of being a coach?
Well, it's the first time in 30 years I don't have my own team, that I'm following and coaching and guiding and those kinds of things. But this has been good because there was a lot of stuff to fix here at Del Valle, and I work for great people who've given me a lot to do. And I still have my son's season to watch, so that fills some of the void. But it has been unique. With that, and for the first time in my life, Matt, I kind of live day to day. I've always been a planner, where I want to be next month or that week, and I kind of do this day to day. But it's been a big challenge at Del Valle, and I work for great people like Chris, I enjoy it. I really do. It's been a challenge. Obviously, I wish we weren't dealing with what we're dealing with, COVID, that kind of challenge, but it has filled a good portion of the void.
So you mentioned your son playing for East Stroudsburg. How difficult is it to, how do you juggle? You're a coach, being a dad, not going too far. He's got a coach. It can be tricky sometimes.
Yeah, I used to break down the video for him of his games. That's the beauty of it, because I didn't see a whole lot of them in person during his high school career. So I'd break down the tape. He'd always say, Dad, it's always negative. You only show him. But I was always trying to make him a better player, like I would all of my players. And there were days you just have to be dad, where he has a bad game or he struggles or he's really happy. And again, there were days, multiple days, where St. Joe's and his high school team played on the same time and my team lost and his team won, or vice versa.
obviously you hope for both teams winning in the same day. So, but he knew, he felt the pain when we lost, and I felt it when he lost. So it's unique, and I wouldn't have had it any other way, and I don't think he would have either.
Dave Duda, thanks so much for joining me. This was a lot of fun.
Matt, great catching up. Stay safe out there, and hope to see you again down the line.
And that will do it for this episode of One on One. Want to thank Delaware Valley University Athletic Director Dave Duda for being our guest. Now, if you like this show and you want to help us out and you listen on Apple Podcasts, leave us a rating and a review. Now, you can follow the show on Twitter at One on One Pod. You can follow me on Twitter as well at MattLeon1060. Thanks again for listening, and tune in again next time for another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
You know how in football, timing is everything? You miss your window by a second and the play's already gone. The holidays are the same way. Everything happens fast, and if you're not ready, you're scrambling at the last minute. That's why Amazon Prime is the real MVP this season.
With Prime's fast, free shipping, you can make those last-minute calls look effortless. Forgot your secret Santa gift? Need something for that office party? Prime's got your back, helping you go from uh-oh to all set faster than a two-minute drill.
Absolutely, Mark, because Prime isn't just about getting things fast. It's about making sure you never miss your shot. It turns that last-minute scramble into a smooth holiday win. So this season, remember, Prime's fast delivery has your back during the holidays, especially when it's down to the wire and can't wait another minute. Last-minute gifts delivered. It's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This holiday season, choose gifts that feel thoughtful and practical with Omaha Steaks. Whether you're hosting or gifting, they deliver the world's best steak experience, and it makes you look like you planned way ahead. They've got USDA-certified tender steaks, juicy burgers, comfort meals, and tons more. Gifting Omaha Steaks is honestly one of the easiest wins. Everything arrives beautifully packaged, super convenient, and the quality is unbelievable. Their filet mignons are some of the most tender I've ever had. And the variety means you can personalize every gift. Plus, orders placed by 6 p.m. Eastern ship same day. And everything is backed by their 100% guarantee. It's holiday gifting made simple. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their Sizzle All the Way sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code T-Bone at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, code T-Bone.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detecttheSOS.com to learn more.